This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology. Workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups. Epson.com.
My, oh my, it's been a busy couple of days for the International Monetary Fund. We'll tell you about that. Also, chickens and the global economy. And maybe the best 50 Shades of Grey story you are ever gonna hear. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times, prepare to read beyond the expected. And by Battelle. Battelle's NeuroBridge technology is helping a paralyzed man to move again. Learn more at battelle.org. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. More at GoToMeeting.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on the 12th of February, everybody. It is Thursday today. The IMF figures prominently in two big stories of the day. Greece has agreed to talks with its creditors, the IMF prominently among them, that would keep Greece on track to repay its bailout and would thus save the eurozone. For now, I suppose I ought to add to that. Also, Ukraine, a ceasefire between the government in Kiev and pro-Russian separatists is set to start on Sunday, along with a new loan program to Ukraine from the IMF, which will bring the fund's contributions to a grand total of $17.5 billion to that country. But all that money does not, as you may have supposed, come free. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains why Ukraine needs it and what they're going to have to do to get it.
With today's announcements, Ian Bremmer at the Eurasia Group says Ukraine has to take the good with the bad.
One way you can put it is that the Ukrainians are losing land, but they're getting money.
And Ukraine needs that money. It's been on the brink of default, with a GDP that shrank last year by 7%.
If you ask me which of the two deals are more important, it's probably the IMF deal, because the IMF deal is more likely to stick.
But the deal comes with conditions that will be painful to swallow, cutting public spending and widespread corruption. Reforms that Peterson Institute fellow Anders Osland points out have to be made up front.
That means that the Ukrainian parliament has to legislate these reforms.
And the legislation is likely to be unpopular, especially when it comes to what he says is the most important, reforming the state-owned natural gas company. Thierry Bross, European gas analyst at Société Générale, says it's been losing around $4 billion a year subsidizing residential heating bills.
This means an IMF needs to provide every year $4 billion, okay? Which is not what IMF wants. IMF wants to provide money not to subsidize gas.
Ukrainians are already paying 50% more for gas than a year ago, thanks to a previous IMF deal. But Bross says they'll have to pay much more to achieve what its lenders want.
The slope is stiff, but there is no way out.
Bross says if the state-owned gas company doesn't stop giving its gas away cheap, it won't be able to afford to bring it into the country at all. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
It's going to get really quiet at big ports up and down the West Coast this weekend. Shipping companies didn't unload much, if any, cargo today. They're going to do the same thing over the coming three-day weekend. And a months-long labor dispute between those companies and longshoremen means container ships are already stacked up from Los Angeles all the way up to Seattle. Lawmakers from both parties are urging President Obama to get involved, while companies big and small that depend on what's on those ships try to tally up the damage. Marketplace's Dan Weissman looks at what it costs to get caught in a busted supply chain.
Lots of businesses are closed for the President's Day weekend. What's the big deal about the ports? Alan Rutter is a researcher at the Texas A&M Transportation Institute.
There are an awful lot of people that are anywhere on the spectrum from concerned to panic.
like manufacturers. These days, they mostly run on just-in-time systems. Worst case scenario, I make refrigerators. Today's shipment of gaskets doesn't show up. My assembly line stops. Robin Burstling looks at transportation and infrastructure for the National Association of Manufacturers.
What manufacturers are exceedingly good at is problem solving and coming up with workarounds.
But workarounds are expensive. For instance, Fuji Heavy Industries says it's paying $60 million a month to fly Subaru parts to U.S. plants to keep things running. There are also businesses trying to get things out of the country, losing customers. Burstling uses French fries as an example. Say the customer in Asia gets impatient.
And they realize, you know what, we're not going to get the French fries from the United States. So we're going to go with a supplier from Europe where we know they can ship out from Rotterdam and make it to us on time.
That example is only halfway made up. Remember when McDonald's in Japan was selling only small servings of fries? This is why. And California citrus growers say they've lost $500 million in foreign business. Retailers are freaking out, too, waiting for imported products. Dan Boaz runs airfreight.com. He's looking at what happens once the ports start moving again.
It could be a whole nother secondary effect nightmare. Everyone's going to want to be in the front of the line, and everyone's going to want to get the freight. And
it's going to be a great opportunity for him. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Much as airlines are consolidating, so too is the online air and travel booking industry. We learned this morning Expedia is going to drop $1.5 billion to buy Orbitz. The deal will narrow the online travel booking field considerably, Priceline being the other major player left standing. So good news for Expedia, but as with any merger, somebody's got to lose, Gigi Duban reports.
If Expedia and Priceline had muscle before, think of them now on steroids. Doug Quinby tracks the travel industry with the research firm Focusrite. He says Expedia already has bargaining power with airlines and hotels to negotiate things like fees and access to inventory.
They've got a lot of customers at their disposal, a big share of the market, so they can command suppliers' attention in a way that smaller players cannot.
Expedia and Priceline make most of their money on hotel bookings, and demand for rooms is high, but he says people want deals.
And if they can't find the rate that they want at this four-star hotel, then they will go to that 3.5-star hotel.
Today's news shouldn't affect consumers' travel costs one way or the other, says Rich Meredick. He's founder of Insight Travel, a market research firm.
I think in the end, this has pushed more pressure on the hotels and squeezes their profits.
Hotels hate paying commissions to online sites. To make sure they don't undercut Expedia or Priceline, say, there are rate parity agreements. Those prevent hotels from advertising lower prices than their online competitors.
But what you also have is hotels jockeying for more direct business, looking for any way to get around those parity arrangements by offering, you know, advanced purchase deals, specials of their own, like packages and upgrades.
In the end, he says it's a share grab game, and that might just work out well for consumers. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Speaking of share grab, don't look now, but the Dow is getting back near 18,000. When did that happen? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Residents in and around Sao Paulo, Brazil, are being encouraged to wash their hands with hand sanitizer, not water, because the city and the surrounding Sao Paulo state, just down the coast from Rio, are in the middle of the worst drought in a century. Lizzie O'Leary, the host of our weekend program, is on assignment in Sao Paulo, so we got her on the line. Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Kai.
Talk to me for a second. Give me a sense of scope of how big this drought is.
It is massive. So we're talking about really the worst water crisis in probably a century. You've got a warm winter, not a lot of rain, bad planning, questionable infrastructure. So there's one stat that will probably blow your mind a little bit.
Yeah.
68% of the people here in Sao Paulo have had problems with the water supply in the past month. So that means the water pressure is lower, and there has been some talk of outright rationing, like maybe a couple of days on, a couple of days off. This is also a really big deal because, you know, Brazil has a lot of hydroelectric power, and none of this is a surprise. I mean, there have been warnings for years about all of this. So I sat down with a former finance minister here, Rubens Recupero, about why this is happening, given that there have been so many warnings. This is what he had to say.
It is a situation that could develop into a crisis. You have all the elements for a perfect storm, except we don't have water.
That's a great line. They don't have the storm.
They don't have the water,
Other than possibly rationing, what's going on? Are they going to make water more expensive? What are they going to do?
So right now we're in this very delicate place where the government's doing price incentives for using less water, some punishment for using more. None of this has really been decided yet. There was an election in October in the state, and so a lot of it was sort of punted until after that. We actually talked to the vice governor of Sao Paulo State, who sort of said, well, you have to put this in context. It would be worse if it were in Argentina. And we were all kind of like,
We're in Brazil.
But we're in Brazil, and you have 20 million people who live here. And we didn't really get a clear answer, to be honest, Kai.
So we're having a drought out here in L.A., right, in California, and yet you still see people, watering their lawns in the morning. What's going on the streets of Sao Paulo? I mean, what are the tangible impacts here?
They are blunter, I think. You know, even in some high-end restaurants, for example, people are using plastic serving ware because restaurants don't want to use the water. Their kids in the public schools are told not to brush their teeth there. The other thing, there's this weird observation. Basically, between midnight and 6 a.m., Sao Paulo has this sort of economy of private water trucks where people drive around selling and delivering water to hotels and the well-off so that they can fill up water boxes at their homes. The taps actually go off in the slums sometimes. And one thing that has been good since we've been here, it's actually started to rain. So that's helped in the reservoirs. People are a little more optimistic, and it's sort of in a wait-and-see mode right now.
Yeah, but as I can tell you from California, a little bit of rain, a drought does not end. Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary. She is in Sao Paulo reporting for the BBC this week. Lizzie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For years, the big bugaboo about the American education system has been that we are behind in the ever more critical STEM disciplines, that we don't have enough kids in high school and college studying science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. There is, though, a preschool here in California that thinks we are not starting them young enough. From KPCC, Deepa Fernandez has more.
On a recent crisp winter morning in Pasadena, a group of early childhood educators gathered to plan their big teaching initiative for the year ahead.
One of the questions was, how are we going to make engineering work in an infant space?
Yes, she did say engineering, and she is the infant teacher. Monica Dolan runs the Bunnies Room at Caltech's Children's Center.
Usually when you think of engineering, you're usually creating something, coming up with the ideas, the blueprints.
Now, we all know infants aren't about to sketch a blueprint, but they can create with some assistance.
You can reach the top tunnel. Whoa, it's gonna fall
it
over.
Might not sound like it, but these little ones, aged 6 to 18 months, are building a climbing structure out of large, soft blocks.
There we go. Now it won't fall over.
It's part of a strategy to get all children to learn through basic engineering principles.
At infant age, if they're already good at stacking and balance, then in the toddler yard, they may already be using scales.
In the next yard, teacher Cedra Chagoya and her toddlers are building a train. They scour the yard for things to make carriages, and they find some empty crates.
Green. So should we go?
Yeah.
All right, get ready.
Back inside, Chagoya quiets the toddlers with a story.
Young Iggy Peck is an architect and has been since he was two, when he built a great tower in only an hour with nothing but diapers and glue.
It's deliberate here. From story time to free play, everything is geared towards age-appropriate learning through engineering principles, says Chagoya.
Because they're between 2 and 3, they're still acquiring a lot of language. So there's a lot of ideas that they have that are nonverbal.
But not speaking doesn't mean they don't get complex concepts.
How are you going to work with the tube, Jayoshi?
Not falling down.
No, the structure is not falling down, you're right.
Jayoshi is just two.
It looks like it's pretty
Toddlers
stable.
Here know and verbalize concepts like stability and balance because they're constantly named and reinforced.
They engineer their own rockets, so do you remember?
And on to the preschool classroom where more complex projects are underway.
Straws.
The regular flexible bendy straws, and then we have
straws.
The big straws. And
teacher Veronica Diag engaged the four-year-olds like they were college students.
So I want to see if you can get your straw rockets to shoot all the way from where you're sitting to the other side of the room.
And each one used tape, plus big and little straws, and figured out how to turn them into a rocket that actually shot across the room.
Veronica, it worked.
Using engineering curriculum with small children is optimizing what new research shows small children's brains are capable of, says Carrie Lynn Draper, STEM director at Caltech's Children's Center.
What this really is about is a process that is natural to children, to get them to ask, to create, to test their ideas. Believe it or not, in the grown-up world, that's called the engineering design process.
But it's not just preschool advocates who believe an engineering education can start young. It's a strategy that has support at the top end of the education pipeline, too. Gregory Washington, Dean of the School of Engineering at UC Irvine, wants more women, Black and Latino engineers in the field, and starting young is key.
If you start in a preschool, you're right about right in order to prepare these kids to be ready as inventors and as problem solvers.
So the next time your toddler grabs some blocks, talk to her about balance and assembly, and you might just be putting her on a path to her future career. In Los Angeles, I'm Deepa Fernandez for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The chicken is a little bit like, well, let's say like the transistor or the H-bomb. It's a child of World War II.
Still tastes like chicken, though. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 110 points today, 0.6%, closed at 17,972, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 56 points, 1.1%, finished at 4,857. The S&P 500 gained 19 points, 0.9%, ended things at 2,088. News this morning that consumer spending barely rose in January, didn't faze the banking world. JPMorgan Chase deposited more than 2%. Morgan Stanley added nearly 1.5%. Goldman Sachs climbed 0.1% today. Expedia and Orbitz, we told you about. Their $1.6 billion deal sent both stocks soaring. Expedia gained 14%, Orbitz 21%. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year Treasury was at 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. The markets may be uncertain, but institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price's disciplined investment approach to help reach their long-term investment goals. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. And by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions designed to help organizations maximize one of their biggest investments, their workforce. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Ebsen, with workforce all-in-one printers powered by Precision Core technology designed to help businesses run at full speed. Where there's business, there's Ebsen. When you're not near a radio, listen to Marketplace on your cell phone or tablet. You can hear us on Slacker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Flipboard, and more, or download our iPhone app. Find the option that's best for you at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace stage book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary February Consumer Sentiment Survey. The United Nations marks World Radio Day, a celebration of radio. And it's Friday the 13th. You know what that means. Only one more day to get a card for your Valentine. Hey, you want to be lucky in love, right? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, I once set up a whole two-minute-long radio story using just two words. Today, a four-minute story in five words. Here you go. 50 Shades of Grey, merchandise. Here's Sally Herships.
Hi. This is one of those awkward stories, so let's just get this out of the way. Some of the 50 Shades of Grey merchandise is the kind I'm embarrassed to talk about, and some I'm not allowed to talk about on the radio. So let's just start with the wine. Paul Katz works at L&P Wines and Liquors in Brooklyn. He says it's not exactly a bestseller, so why is he selling it?
Honestly, my wife.
Katz wasn't sure if his wife had read the book, so he called her.
Did you read the book, 50 Shades of Grey? Yeah, which part? All three of them? Wow. Do you want to go to the movie to see it?
Another ticket sold. But there's going to a movie in the dark. Then there's buying one of those products.
I'm trying to be discreet. I mean, I haven't said cock.
Wait! Christy Faulkner is president of Womenkind. It helps companies advertise and market to women. She was about to say one of those things we're not allowed to say on the radio.
But Target is selling them. Who knew? Who could believe that?
In case you haven't heard, Target is selling 50 Shades of Grey adult devices, the kind with batteries.
Are you going to throw your 50 Shades of Grey electronic device into your cart with your laundry detergent and your diet soda and your baby food and your Pampers? You know, is that really going to happen?
Unclear. But Faulkner says all this 50 Shades merchandise is doing something. She calls it permission marketing. A 50 Shades of Grey t-shirt could make a taboo subject a little more approachable for men.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's an opportunity for guys who didn't read the book but want to benefit from the ideas, so to speak.
Say, by bringing home a 50 Shades of Grey teddy bear to their wife or girlfriend from the Vermont Teddy Bear Company.
It's quite the bear.
Jen Drexler is with Insight Strategy Group. She helps brands understand consumers. Mr. Bear is gray with a little gray suit, but also a tiny mask and handcuffs.
It is one of those, like, flip things that you can't believe you live in a world where this can happen. So it's so awesome.
And FYI, the Vermont Teddy Bear Company says so far this is its best-selling Valentine's Day bear ever.
But you have to wonder, like, when does licensing cross over into value for the brand, which is 50 Shades of Grey is a brand, when it goes into gag gifts?
While the 50 Shades brand is getting paid a royalty based on the sales of the bears, Drexler says if no one is putting the teddy bear on their bed or their baby in a onesie that says 9 months ago, mommy read 50 Shades of Grey, it won't do much for the 50 Shades brand. She says the problem is this particular brand is one women want to keep private.
There's a reason women weren't getting together to talk about, you know, I've always wanted to be tied up. Like, that is not replacing Oprah's book club anytime soon.
Maybe not, but the women at the book clubs are the target audience for 50 Shades merchandise. So I brought some to a group in Brooklyn to get the members, all moms, to give feedback. They were mostly okay with the 50 Shades of Grey baby clothes as a joke. The wine was a bit of a flop, but approved as a gag gift. But Renata Segura freaked out when she saw the bear.
That is not okay. That is not okay. Wait, is this for a child or for a grown-up?
No, I don't want that as a present. I mean, maybe from somebody else, but not from my bank account.
And Mr. Bear is $89.99. So 50 Shades of Grey merchandise, okay, but maybe only if somebody else pays for it. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Consider this for just a moment, would you? If the chicken went away tomorrow, the global economy as we know it would basically cease to exist. That's one of the many takeaways from a new book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? Andrew Lawler wrote it. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Kai.
To paraphrase Renee Zellweger, if I might, you had me at the first line of this book. Add up all the world's cats, dogs, pigs, and cows, and there would still be more chickens. Toss in every rat on Earth, and the bird still dominates. Are you serious? That's crazy.
Who would have thought? Yes, it is true. And the funny thing is that the chicken, maybe 50 or 60 years ago, was kind of an obscure animal, but suddenly it's come to dominate the planet.
It is, you write, the most, even though it can't fly, it is the most migratory bird in the world because it gets transshipped.
It goes everywhere. And a single bird that is grown, say, in the United States might end up in 6 or 7 different countries depending on its parts. So, for example, we Americans like the breast meat. The Dutch like the bone so they can make soup. Other people like the dark meat. It goes everywhere across the planet.
Chicken being such a staple of the global diet, especially in this country, is relatively recent. I mean, it's like post-World War II, right? This thing called the chicken of tomorrow.
Yes, the chicken is a little bit like the transistor or the H-bomb. It's a child of World War II. It is the result of scientists and engineers, along with chicken keepers, breeding a bird that could be grown very, very quickly using very, very little feed.
The chicken of tomorrow. a broad-breasted bird with bigger drumsticks, plumper thighs, and layers of white meat, like the wax model on the right.
It's actually, I mean, it was a government program. They went out and did a contest or something.
Well, it was actually started by A&P, which was the Walmart of its day. And the person who was in charge of marketing at A&P got this idea that hey, as soon as the war is over, as soon as World War II ends, people are going to go back to eating pork and beef, because people weren't eating pork and beef during the war because that was reserved for the troops. So people had to rely on chicken. Mm. So the new chicken industry that grew up in World War II was extremely concerned people would go back to their old ways. So they set out to come up with chicken that would be as appealing to American consumers as the cow or the pig, something that would look like a steak.
They sure make wonderful eating. Yes, sir. Make mine chicken. Chicken of tomorrow, that is.
What is it about chickens that you say makes them the great economic equalizer?
The chicken was really critical when the Industrial Revolution hit in the 1800s. There was great concern around the industrialized world that we couldn't feed people. We couldn't feed those factory workers, and the economy would grind to a halt, or there would be a revolution of the proletariats. And the chicken provided a way to get cheap protein to those workers. And it made a huge impact, and is actually making a huge impact even today across the developing world. China and South America are two areas with booming chicken businesses. And, of course, they're taking that industry directly mm-hmm. from the American model, which means they'll have a lot of cheap protein. It also means they will have some of the same problems we have.
How are they regulated? Are they regulated? They got to be regulated, right?
Well, they are and they're not. One of the most peculiar things I discovered was that the chicken is not considered an animal if it's raised for food.
Oh.
So unlike, say, the pig or the cow, chickens are actually considered to be something other than an animal. And there are no regulations regulating the treatment of chickens if they're not in a circus or they're not in a research lab.
Hmm. Do you eat chickens?
This is a difficult question, and I do. I will succumb to convenience because I'm an American. I enjoy convenience. But I'm also a little more aware of how chickens are raised and that there are some growing alternatives for American consumers to choose a chicken that not only was raised in a more humane fashion, but just as importantly, also tastes better.
It's a book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World by Andrew Lawler. Andrew, thanks very much for your time.
It was a pleasure, Kai.
We don't quite clear up the which came first argument, but we do have 12 more crazy facts about chicken from Andrew Lawler's book. They are online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which the don't put all your eggs in one basket lesson is learned the very hard way. American Express CEO Ken Chenault did an unscheduled call with analysts today to warn everybody that Amex's deal with warehouse retailer Costco is going to expire next year. Amex shares lost 6.5% as a result, pretty much promptly. Most interesting factoid of the whole story, though, the average Costco customer has an income of $100,000 a year.
Marketplace is supported by Burst, cloud business analytics engineered to let every business user make better data-driven decisions every moment of every day. Learn more at BIRST.com. Burst, think fast. And by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And by UCLA Anderson School of Management, where students and executives learn to think in the next. Anderson.ucla.edu.
All righty, got to go. Today, the Dow up 110 points, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ added 56 points. That is 1.1%. The S&P 500 gained 19 points, 0.9%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.